welcome to episode 51 of TechAU. My name is Jason Cartwright, and this has been recorded on 14th of November 2010. Got a lot for you today. We've got Call of Duty Black Ops. What's in the new Facebook announcement coming up this week? Twitter's got some new numbers, and a whole bunch of other great stuff. So let's work through that. Starting off with this little puppy here, Call of Duty Black Ops. So this is the latest in a series of Call of Duty games. If you haven't ever heard of Call of Duty, you've been sleeping under a rock, and it's time to come out from underneath it. But Call of Duty is a very well-known franchise, and this game actually broke the entertainment sales record for first day sales. So many, many million, I believe around seven or eight million copies in the first day, and hugely successful. And it is a great game. I got it on launch day and played through it. I played a few hours that first day and then right through and finished it on the second day. It's not the longest game in the world, but it's probably a little longer than the previous ones. So Modern Warfare 2 and World at War and that sort of stuff. So it took me, I played on just regular, so about the second of four difficulty levels. I played through in about 8 to 8.5 hours of sort of roughly tracking my usage, not to the minute, but around 8 and 8.5 hour marks for the single player campaign. So basically you travel all over the world. I'm not going to throw any spoilers out there. I'll let you guys play it and enjoy it for yourself. You play as as a couple of different characters, but the storyline jumps over throughout the world during the Cold War sort of time period. So pretty interesting, pretty engaging. It is a little, jump aroundy sort of thing. You've got to be paying attention when it does do the cutscenes, when you finish levels, that sort of jazz. I found that it was pretty healthy for achievements. Without too much effort at all, you work through, and obviously at the end of each stage, you seem to get an achievement. There's some extra ones along the way. I most certainly don't have all the achievements. There's a lot more in multiplayer that you would need to play through to get those. Obviously some hidden achievements and that sort of stuff, even in single player. But you do get the option to play locally via System Link or over Xbox Live, which is nice because not all multiplayer games do that these days. Some of them do just force you to go and have gold subscription and play on Xbox Live. So that's a nice variety. In terms of its online multiplayer, it's very much the same as any other first-person shooter, unless you are spending a countless amount of hours in there and just really refining your skills. You're pretty much going to get creamed. You might get the occasional kill, but there's a lot of 14-year-old boys sitting around with plenty of time to spare to practice up and take you down when you jump in there. So I haven't played too much in multiplayer. I spent most of my time getting through the single player campaign. I did thoroughly enjoy it. So look, it's recommended retail is $119. Don't pay that for it. Look around. I picked it up for around $85. I've heard reports of it being even under $80. So I have written a review on the site. So if you haven't been there and checked that out, you can do that for more information. TechAU.tv. If you didn't already know what the address was, but yeah, that's Call of Duty Black Ops. It was the big news last week. So next up is, I guess, the Xbox 360 dashboard update in readiness for Kinect. Now, the US already have Kinect. It's already launched over there, but we're still waiting here in Australia till the 18th. So this week, Kinect should hit our shores. So really looking forward to Kinect, actually. I think it's going to be quite a different experience than the Wii or the PlayStation Move, which I have both of. And I'm really looking forward to the new possibilities. Even things like the voice control is meant to be awesome. And, you say Xbox Play Movie or Play DVD or whatever it be. But even the menus basically show up. It's intelligent about the way it does it. It shows up the options, I guess, similar to the voice narration. When you hold the home button of your iPhone or in the smartphone, Android does it as well, that you can, it shows you the options or the things you can say on screen. So Kinect will do that as well. So when you say Xbox, it will bring up, if you've got eight menu options, it will bring up the word that you need to say to activate each one of those. A long-winded explanation, but basically the voice is meant to be really good. I'm really looking forward to getting some of the activities-related games, so the fitness apps, into a bit of a fitness mode at the moment in the lead-up to summer, so been working out a bit, and so I'm interested to see if this could be a viable, you know, addition to the workout routine, so not just treadmill and weights and stuff, but actually a bit of, not so much dance, I mean, there will be dance games, but yeah, more the instructor-led, like having a personal trainer, basically. It'll be interesting to see how that goes. So I'll certainly review those games when Kinect comes out and I get hold of those. The update itself also includes video calling, so you can, because it's Microsoft and Windows Live ID all connected, you can basically video call from Kinect from your lounge chair to somebody on their desktop. No doubt in the future, you'll be able to do that to a mobile client as well. I don't believe any Windows Phone 7 devices have front-facing cameras at this stage. I believe that's the choice of the hardware manufacturer. They could put it in if they want, but then they would obviously have to write the software application to take advantage of that. So that really needs to come from Microsoft if that's going to happen. You know, something similar to FaceTime, but being able to talk to, you know, not phone to phone, but also to the desktop and just to people in the lounge room. And I sort of thought of the possibility of getting my parents an Xbox 360. I actually have a spare one. See my upgrade to the Slim. So maybe give them my old Xbox, buy them a Kinect for Christmas or something, and then they can sit on the couch and we can do video calls. I think that would be very, very easy process for them to switch inputs effectively, turn on their Xbox, and then we're away and chatting. So obviously can configure it so it auto signs in and they don't have to worry about any of that. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to Kinect, and that's about all. I'll definitely have a review and check out the site when that comes out, because there's going to be a lot of news around it. I'm kind of very jealous the US got that first. We got our taste of Windows Phone 7 before them, so I guess it's a sort of a leveler, but let's move on to the Nvidia fastest GPU in the world. So, or not in the world, but certainly in the consumer space. So obviously enterprise and business and specialty cards are out there and the higher end stuff for thousands of dollars. But in terms of general consumer availability, the things that enthusiasts are going to buy and build their own machines with, Nvidia released the GTX 580. So this is blistering fast, the fastest card on the market. And I haven't seen any Australian prices for that, but usually when top-end video cards come out, they are around the, you know, up towards $1,000, sometimes peaking over that. The good thing about a new Nvidia card coming out is that all their existing cards will drop in price. So if you were looking at one, holding off for a little bit, just wait probably, you know, a couple of weeks at least, maybe a month, for those prices to be adjusted. And with the Aussie dollar being strong as well, that might help. And so the price of those cards, anything in the Nvidia line, should all drop in comparison, because obviously their performance per dollar is less. So good news for system builders out there. Personally, I haven't built my own system for many years, but did that for quite a while. I really enjoyed it, and it's a good experience if you've never done it before. Just learn what you're doing first. There's a lot of resources online on how to do it, but it's really quite simple. And bit of practice and you'll be away and racing. The good news is that today compatibility is pretty strong. The other thing I'll add is that Nvidia, if you do run Nvidia cards, go and check the latest drivers. I myself did that this week and realized I'd been slacking and a few versions behind, and they do give you some advantages when you upgrade your software for the GPU. You can get extra frame rate for free effectively in games, increased performance, so reduce render times if you're ripping a DVD or a CD and that sort of jazz. Anything that touches the GPU, you'll get usually benefits from a new upgraded firmware, software. And the other one would be just if you're using something like Creative Suite, which I do. So check it out, Nvidia software. I'm a big fan of Nvidia, as you can probably tell. I have touched AMD ATI cards, but AMD, but my preference is certainly towards Nvidia. I think they're better. On to Twitter news. Twitter had a milestone. This is probably just over a week now this news came out, that Twitter has hit the 175 million user mark. So while all the news and press and all that is around Facebook with the social network movie coming out, and them obviously at 500 million users, Twitter is climbing up there very, very rapidly. I mean, they're seeing some incredible growth rates, and that doesn't seem to be slowing off. So as more and more celebrities start to talk about it, their influence and audience starts to wonder and find out about what Twitter is. And now we've got more and more businesses coming online and services. And to be honest, if you're a business or a service company that doesn't have a Twitter account right now, however you choose to use that, whether it be customer service or PR or however you decide to use that, that's fine. But I think that you absolutely need a presence on Twitter. It's something that more and more users will expect. And as 175 million starts to grow towards, 200, 300 million users, I mean, you're starting to talk to basically a large majority of the population. So when you start to get that volume, if the user then expects that they can go to twitter.com/ whatever your business or product is, and you don't have an account, they're going to be disappointed, or maybe just, I don't know, maybe they could stumble across an alternate competitor or something. So certainly I've found it incredibly valuable to be on Twitter. I've made some amazing connections with people that I never would have otherwise met. I find it incredibly useful to crowdsource information. So with a decent following base, I'm up to over 2,000 followers now, that you can ask a question and somebody's going to have a solution for you, a great link to a resource, or they're going to know the answer from their own experience. I think it's fantastic. And it's more and more I will go to companies if I have issues with their product or service. I will find their Twitter address, and you can usually just do that by Googling the name of the service plus Twitter, or Bing if you prefer, and then you'll find their Twitter account as just like at Telstra. Any company you can think of is just at, and you might even want to try just twitter.com/ whatever the product is, and you'll find that service, and then you just write to them, and if they're paying attention and they're using Twitter properly, they're going to respond to you pretty quickly. And I've found that to be really a much better way to get in contact and get things done, rather than sit on the phone to a company for 2 hours. You usually, if they're paying attention, if they've got a social media team looking after their Twitter account, then you're going to be able to get a response very quickly. And that's certainly been in my experiences. I wrote a post about that in terms of Telstra, but certainly a lot of other companies as well. In terms of review products, that's probably the next story I want to go on to. It's a fantastic way as well. If you're looking for myself, if you do a podcast or a blog or whatever it be, and you review products, then you could basically just find people online and say, hey, I'm looking to review XYZ. Does anybody know the contact for that? And then they get put in, you get put in touch with it. So I'm still waiting for that Samsung Omnia 7 review unit for Windows Phone 7, by the way. So hopefully that's very, very soon. And I'm a little worried that once I get hands-on with that thing, I'm going to want to buy it. Definitely want to compare and contrast against the iPhone 4. So with that, I want to move on to this little puppy here, which is a review unit I've had for a little over a week now, I guess. And it's an iPad case with a built-in keyboard. So how does it all work? So basically, we have this little puppy here. And it's actually a really nice leather sort of finish to it. Looks kind of like a small briefcase. It's good fit and finish on it. Looks really professional. Now, it does add a little bulk compared to the standard Apple case, which I have here. Obviously, there's no iPad in here, but that's much, much thinner than the one with the keyboard. So you are, it's a much stronger case. It's not going to bend or flex or whatever. And it looks a lot more stylish than the Apple case, which actually gets pretty beat up over time. I don't know if you can see it, but there's a lot of marks and crap on there. So if we open it up, basically we've got the iPad sits in there and the keyboard's there. So we slide it out, and I'll probably do a review video on this, so check out the review section of the site. It's techau.tv/reviews, and basically you fold it like that, so you form a little triangle, and the iPad stands up, so you can use it like basically with a keyboard, which feels like a laptop. So in one of the things I noticed this week in using it is that because it feels so much like a laptop, you start to actually look for the mouse in this area. So just naturally your thumb, which would use the mouse, or your pointer finger would use the mouse on a trackpad if this was a laptop, just sort of, I guess, intuitively or naturally using laptops for a number of years, I go to reach for that trackpad and obviously it's not there. It does have a series of dedicated buttons along the top here. So we've got things like home. So no matter where you are, you know, and obviously the touchscreen still works. No matter where you are, you can just hit home and it's going to throw you back to the home screen. There's also a lock button on the right there, so you can lock the screen. And again, we'll just unlock that. There's a search button. So if you want to search for an application, you know, Evernote, it's a bit hard to type like this, but you know, we get it there. So it works really well. It works in Pages and Notes and the browser, basically any application that you would normally use the on-screen keyboard for, it can handle. There is, first of all, before I get onto the downsides, let me basically just run you through how it actually works, how the keyboard connects to the iPad. So it's all done through Bluetooth. And there's a small section in the case, so built into the case, and you hardly even notice it, but it's a small section there. It's got a micro USB plug to charge the thing, so that's something you need to get used to, is having to charge your iPad case. The next is a little button to enable Bluetooth to turn it on. The switch is to enable Bluetooth, and then you sync it by pressing the button. So when you do that, you go into the Bluetooth on the iPad, under settings, and you turn Bluetooth on and then you pair it. So all that setup is actually pretty easy. You just have to remember to keep it charged. Now, I said I'd get to the downsides. So the downside is that because it folds up nicely, this actually contains a magnet when it folds over. So it doesn't have any clip or clasp or anything. But the downside is if you've had that bent for quite a while, that's what you end up with. And so if you're typing, this can actually get in the way of where you want. You want that completely ideally, you'd get rid of this section altogether or fold it underneath or something, but you can't really do that. So it's kind of in the way when it's all folded out. The other issue is because you've got the lock icon here, when you close it up, I've had times where the iPad will be off, so you turn it off, you're going to put it away, and then you open it up and the screen's back on. Now, what happens there is because the screen's running, depending on your brightness, irregardless of your brightness, it's going to drain your battery if the screen's running for the entire time it's just sitting on your bench and it's closed. So I found that to be basically a massive issue, and I'm not sure of a solution how they could solve that. Other than maybe getting rid of those keys that are active, while it's shut, you can't really sort of just turn off keys. So, if it's going to drain your battery really quick, I was at work the other day and needed to use it in a meeting and went to turn it on and it was flat. So, and for the iPad, that's a really rare thing. Any iPad owners really sort of know that at any time you can, you know, you charge it up and then at any time you can just use it for the next, you know, 3, 4, 5 days, I mean, up to a week sort of thing with occasional usage. So for me to turn it on, it to be flat, it was like a really weird feeling. And and then I worked out what did it because it happened again. So that is something, probably a pretty major flaw of the iPad case. Look, in terms of text input, I'm a touch typist. I can, you know, do it without looking. And type pretty fast just from years of keyboard use. And obviously the input method is, it's a lot faster to type on. Because of the size of the iPad is 10 inches, then the keyboard is very similar size to a netbook. And it is a little cramped, but I can still be a lot faster typing on the keyboard than I can on the on-screen keyboard. The other downside is that you basically lose the portrait orientation of the case. If I just open it up again, I'll show you what I mean. Is that with the Apple case, Apple iPad case, you can basically just turn it and use it in portrait mode, and that's fine. With this, there's no real way to use the iPad with the case on in portrait mode without having this big clunky keyboard sort of hanging off it. So if I take this out and put it in the Apple case, I'll show you exactly what I mean. So let me just throw this in the Apple case. Wait for 2 seconds. Now, this Apple case is getting a little degraded over time, I guess. I've been using it for many months and taking it in and out and that sort of jazz. So, all right. So, say if we've got the iPad in the Apple case, you can use that, you know, fold this back into the triangle. You can use it in portrait or landscape or however you want. Now, for me, that's brilliant because there are some apps, as you'd know, that only work in portrait mode. You know, and so if you've got the big keyboard hanging off it, it can be, you know, basically you're not going to use it in portrait mode. So landscape only, you're not going to be able to use that, say, on an airplane with the tray table sort of being limited space. So for my mind, it is a solution for those people who really want a keyboard. But I think probably a better solution would be just to get that physical Bluetooth keyboard. I know it's a pain to carry another accessory. But yeah, to have the freedom of, you know, just using the normal Apple case, setting that in a triangle and just using that as a screen and being able to have that keyboard, you know, a bigger, fuller size keyboard, I think that'd be a better solution to the problem. All right, next up, I have a bit of a gripe, and this is about internet and data charges and plans that are just out of control. So basically, with the emergence of tablet category, so iPads and the Galaxy S and Telstra's T-Tab Touch, and everybody's getting into the game. And this is before even Android's officially announced their tablet OS. So right now, the people that are building tablets on Android aren't officially supported by Google. But there's a lot coming out. And so with that, there's basically 3G data plans that are coming along with the tablets. So obviously these are optional. You can get just the Wi-Fi versions if you like. I just sort of posed the question this week on Twitter. Are people prepared to pay for a tablet data plan as well as a mobile data plan as well as their home internet plan at the same time? And some people suggested, look, just get a 3G, you know, mobile Wi-Fi hotspot and you can just share that amongst any of your devices. And while that might be a good solution for your mobile devices, your tablets and your phones, and your laptops, it's probably not a great solution for your home internet, where you want faster speeds, you want to do video and audio chats and that sort of stuff, and you don't want the latency of going up and down to the satellite, that sort of stuff. So what I want in an ideal world would be, if you're with a provider that offers all of these solutions, so an Optus or a Telstra, somebody like that who offers these services across the board, that you just pay a single bill and you pay once for data. So if you buy 100 gig of data for, you know, $60 or whatever it be a month, then it's up to you whether you use that on your home internet, via your computer or laptops or in the home, or whether you're out on the go and you're connecting through the cell towers or however you get your data from your tablet or from your mobile phone. It's all just drawing from that 100 gig. And even if you had the family plan, maybe you want 150 gig and you want the whole family to share that, you pay one bill and register the devices, for example, and then you can just go nuts. So I think, ideally, from a user perspective, that would just be 100 times easier and 100 times simpler. And you're not paying exorbitant rates for mobile data. You're just paying the same flat fee, whatever it be, per meg. It doesn't matter where you use that. You're just paying for data. They might argue that it costs them more to deliver over the mobile infrastructure than it does over the copper network. I'm sorry, but I'm just not interested in that anymore. It's all built and it works, and whatever cost recovery they need for those for that infrastructure, I'm sure that's gonna already have happened or gonna be, you know, arriving very shortly, and that all will be paid off. They're just really milking that money from consumers every month. So I don't believe that they need to make an extra amount on the data that goes over mobile networks than they do over the copper networks. I think that for simplicity, it should just all be on one bill, and the users can use it wherever the hell they want. So that's my little, I guess, rant for the week. I'd be interested to know your opinions. You can reply to me on Twitter, TechAU. Send me an email about it, jason@techau.tv, or leave a comment on the podcast post that goes up. And for a final story this week, sort of tie back to an earlier story, that is, Microsoft have made a deal with Samsung, and every one of their internet-connected TVs, which is pretty much a lot of the new ones that are coming out now, all have Ethernet connections in the back. Every one of those is going to come with Windows Live Messenger built into it. So you won't actually need an Xbox and a Kinect to video call from a Samsung TV to Microsoft Live Messenger on the desktop. So I could be here. If my parents get a Samsung TV, it's internet connected, it's going to come with Live Messenger. You know, we set them up with the account and auto sign in and that sort of jazz. They just hit video call, or maybe I call them and it shows up on the screen. They hit accept and then we're talking. So I'm assuming that those Samsung TVs are going to have some sort of microphone array technology similar to what's in Kinect, so that it can noise cancel. Kinect is really, really smart. Sorry to get back on this, but Kinect is smart in that it knows the sound output that's coming out of Kinect, and so it can use that to cancel all that audio out that it's hearing back through the microphone. So obviously if you're, you know, 4 or 5, 6 foot away from your TV, that's hard for a microphone usually to get your audio clear, given everything that could be going on around. You're playing back a movie, or, you know, there's environmental sounds. It can do a lot of noise cancelling because it knows all the audio that's coming out of Kinect. It can just cut that, or out of your Xbox, it can just cut that out of the source, and then it can work out the majority of what's coming out as your voice. So as long as these TVs have as good a solution as Kinect, I think that's going to be a good win for consumers. And hopefully Samsung's not the only one. Hopefully a lot of the other manufacturers see this as a good way forward and partner with Microsoft. And it makes sense. They are the biggest online service. So while people are fans of Google and Yahoo and that sort of jazz, Microsoft are massive, especially in Australia. Some countries maybe not. Australia, there's, you know, 9 or 10 million Australians on have a Live ID, so it's insanely popular. So it makes sense, and all about the ease of use for the end user. So with that, there's one final thing for this week, and that is I need your help. So basically, what I'm trying to do is, after producing TechAU for the last few years and building the audience up, I would like to start generating some revenue from TechAU, and what that'll allow me to do is do things more often, increase production value, and just generally make it better for you guys. You know, things like get more review products for the site, whether it be buy new gear or new set design or whatever it be. It'd be great to bring in a bit of cash flow. So there has been sponsors on the site previously. What I'm looking at doing is getting these episodes of the podcast, now I'm doing them regularly again, getting them sponsorship as well. So I'm using a service called PodTrack, which is actually what Twit uses as well. That's where I got the idea from. And what they require us to do is to get an audience to complete surveys. So they've got data on what the sort of viewers and listeners are of the podcast. So what I need you to do is go to techau.tv/survey. So I've set up the easy redirect there. And so you'll get redirected to the PodTrack survey site. It's a pretty quick, short survey. So please just take the time. It would really be helpful to me to do that. So I really appreciate your help with this one. I'm going to be throwing this out on the podcast for the next 2 months. That's what they require. And hopefully that information gets back to the advertisers. PodTrack can sell some advertising on the podcast, and everybody's happy. So TechAU.tv/survey. And with that, guys, it's all over for this week. This has been episode 51. I'm Jason Cartwright. And get some more Black Ops into you if you haven't already. It's a good game. Bye.